Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And today it's my honor to invite a co-host that I've known for a number of years. He's the publisher of Suspense Magazine, the founder of Suspense Radio, and a guy who's becoming a good friend of mine. And his name is John Robb. And John, thanks for being here.
Stephen, thank you so much for inviting me to come on. It's so wonderful because I kind of produced the show for you, and now I'm actually on the show, so it's like I'm going to be hearing myself. Yeah, so this is exciting. And I don't really have to do much with the show because you're the host, so I get to sit back, relax, and just have some fun.
You know, John, I think I remember when we were chatting about just doing this show, we had met up in New York, and I said, hey, I've got this idea for this, you know, radio program that would really kind of dive into the meat of storytelling. You were like, let's do it. I was like, well, I was just sort of thinking about the – no, you're like, let's do it. And I was like, well, let me think. You're like, when will we start?
So, yeah, let's do it. I mean, it's been, what, a year and a half later?
Done more than 30 interviews, so it's just
– oh, yeah, you've done a lot. Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's great to have you, John. And today's guest has a wide range of talents. C.E. Lawrence has received glowing reviews from the Library Journal, Kirkus, Booklist, Publishers Weekly, and many others for her gritty novels. She serves up intricate and compelling suspense novels that one professor of forensic psychology said were accurately capturing the logic and intuition of a profile under pressure. And in addition to being a novelist, she's an award-winning playwright, poet, and performer. And so, Carol, I don't know if you want me to use your official name or your pen name, but Carol, thanks for coming on and being here today.
Well, actually, I use both names. And C.E. Lawrence is the one that I use for thrillers and dark fiction. And then Carol Bugay is the name that I have all my other work under, including my plays and I think all my poetry and, you know, what have you, some short stories, kind of depending on the genre. You know, it's that whole branding thing everyone's doing these days. You know,
right. What's
your brand?
I know, they do that. And, you know, I don't know what your take is on it, you guys, but for me, I think that the more you brand yourself, the more you paint yourself into a corner, because then people look you up and they're like, oh, well, she writes gothic horror. And you're like, yeah, but I also write mysteries for teenagers, or I also write fantasy or something. But the first thing they Google comes up, and then they like pigeonhole you. I don't know. I mean,
I think that's one reason that people use different names. I mean, I have mixed feelings about having, you know, I mean, Lawrence really is a family name, so I really am a Lawrence, and I just used my first initial, you know, second initial, you know, so it's Carol Elizabeth, and then Lawrence is my maternal family. So it really is a name in the family, but I also feel that if you have too many names, then people are going to lose sight of who you are altogether. So I just was talking about this with my agent yesterday, and it's a really strange conundrum. You know, what name do I use for what? And, you know, and there's some really, really famous writers who write under more than one name. You're probably aware of this. Joyce Carol Oates, Stephen King, and Anne Rice all use pen names for fiction that's not what they're usually known for.
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, I could go on for 45 minutes about branding, but that's a whole other topic.
Please, no, really, please do, Stephen. I was going to have some coffee anyway, so I'll just kind of put you on speakerphone, and I'll just like put my feet up.
This is John, and I've talked about this a lot, and to me, I am just not a fan of branding. I don't like the term. I don't like people to be listed as a brand. I mean, I think that should be saved for Coca-Cola or Nike or a product you buy. But when you start putting people in the term of, you know, well, don't mess up my brand, I just want to punch them. I really do.
I'm just
not a fan of that.
I totally agree with you, but how do you like this one, John? I was at a conference, I don't know, over the summer, and someone said, well, you know, of course, now you don't think of yourself as authors. You think of yourselves as content providers.
Oh,
how do you like
Lord.
That one? How do you like that one?
I think I just threw up in my mouth a little bit. I got to tell you, I don't understand everything in today's world. Everywhere you look have to have a label, and they want to put you in a box, or they want to put you in a cubbyhole. It's like everybody is trying to fit something into a puzzle piece instead of just basically saying, we're all authors, we're all writers, we all try to tell the absolute greatest stories that we possibly can through our work.
Yeah.
Why can't that just be enough?
Yeah, well...
I don't know. I don't get it. But, you know, but the world's changing, and I guess that's what... Everybody has to have some kind of title, it seems, or some kind of thing instead of just a basic, hey, you know what? I'm just a guy who writes. I'm just a guy who publishes. I'm just a guy on the radio. I'm just a guy or a girl. That's all I am.
You know what?
But
I think I'm going to put that in my next business card.
There you go.
Okay.
I'm just a girl who writes.
Just a girl who writes.
That's it, because when it all breaks down, it's all about entertainment anyway, right?
Yeah.
I mean, whatever we do, we're all trying to entertain in whatever medium or form that we've decided to do on that day or that time. We just want to entertain people. That's
and
it.
And get paid for it.
And get paid a little bit, yeah. You know, we all want to eat some bread. That's about it.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because in Woodstock, everyone I know has given up bread. Thank God you said eat bread. I was talking to a friend the other day, and she kind of guiltily admitted that she eats bread, and I'm like, oh, my God, get over it.
And
I
kale.
Love bread.
Maybe bread with kale would be okay.
No,
I suppose.
God.
Oh, my Lord. Why can't it just be bread? Whatever happened to the simple things in life? Just give me blueberry Pop-Tarts. I don't need cookies and cream and birthday cake.
There you go. Oh, my God, I can't believe you said blueberry Pop-Tart. Now I'm
Yeah, see, I'm telling you, I'm getting into the food right now. We better start going on to some of the storytelling, or this is going to turn into a freaking cooking show.
Carol, I do think we did meet in New York, probably at Thriller Fest or maybe at Killer Nashville. I can't really recall, but
we met at Thriller Fest when you were the charming and very well prepared host of two panels that I was on.
Thank you very much.
As I said before, you know, the amount of prep that you do is always a little intimidating, and I, you know, as someone who comes from comedy improv, I'm so used to winging it that when I turned up and you were so prepared, I was like, wow, you know, I should have done homework. I should have learned more about myself. I'm not sure I can get through this interview.
No, that's actually, Carol, no, I appreciate that. And what you just mentioned is interesting, too, because I studied improv back in the day.
I know.
And I think that our paths, was it with Keith Johnstone?
I never had the pleasure of studying with Keith, though I was, as everyone else in the improv scene was, I was running around New York with a copy of Impro tucked in my bag all times. That was the Bible. I even had an acting teacher, like a straight-up acting teacher, who used that book for a year in our studio to teach from it. It made such a big impression on all of us.
No.
And I got to see his group, Loose Moose, perform. When they came down from Toronto, I got to see them perform and do a lot of mask work. We were all really into mask work in those days. So I didn't get to study with him, but I did study with Del Close.
Oh, yeah.
And who was just a genius. I mean, it's one of those people where I had read Jeff Sweet's book, so many times. Jeff Sweet, by the way, is a playwright and a guy who wrote a book called Something Wonderful Right Away, which was the history of the Second City and the Compass Players in Chicago. And I had read it, and then, Del Close turns up, and, it was he was just as brilliant as I had hoped he would be.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting because, when I took this improv class, it actually did teach me a lot about characterization.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that, as a writer, when I'm shaping a story, when I'm crafting a story, I always ask, well, what could go wrong? Like, what could be, how can I make things worse? Like, add more conflict, tension, like this.
Yeah.
When you're
yeah.
doing improv, though, it's almost like you're looking for a way to agree. Someone says, hey, let's jump on the airplane with this elephant. You're like, absolutely, let's do it. You're looking for a way to create, no, we're not going to take the elephant. Because immediately the scene is dead.
Well, what agreement in improv is all about is pushing the story forward, allowing the story to go forward. So the agreement thing has more to do with agreeing with your fellow actors and your fellow improvisers. So if someone says, let's get on that train, there might be a murderer on it, but let's get on it anyway. You say yes because you have to allow the story to go forward. But
yeah.
you're definitely looking to create conflict. And I think the way that, I mean, improv is like writing, except you're writing on your feet, basically. And I think what I learned most was that it's all about making choices. And so I think that when people come to improv, once they get over, you know, the initial, you know, hurdles of saying no and you're blocking, you know, what's called blocking, then the big thing that you have to get used to is making choices and making big choices. And I think that's what separates people maybe from people who, I mean, I ended up doing it professionally for a number of years and that was really fun. But I think that if you're willing to make choices a lot, then, you know, you move on to the next level. And I think that's what writing is. I mean, I think that what is the most intimidating thing about writing is that you have to make choices all the time. And the choices have to lead you into a place where it becomes more and more dangerous for your protagonist. And that's hard. You know?
Yeah, book, it really is a million choices waiting to be made, you know. Every word is the right word, and
you know, when people talk, I'm not really 100% sure what writer's block is. Maybe you guys can help me out there. But I think maybe when people talk about writer's block, they're talking about just being frozen at the point of being exhausted with making choices or being unable to make a choice or maybe being unable to think, well, that's a choice I'm willing to live with, but what if this choice would work out better? And I think what improv taught me is that it doesn't matter, just make the choice and move on, because in improv you don't have the luxury of self-reflection. You just have to keep going forward.
Right. I mean, what I always see is no matter what choice you're going to make, it's going to lead you down a path where you're going to have more choices anyway. And so it doesn't really make a difference maybe which you do at the onset, depending on where it leads you. There was a very smart man that I took his class one time that talked about writing yourself into a corner and decided, you know what, it's a good place to write yourself into a corner because then that's where you find most of your creative ideas. Is when you write yourself into a corner. Now, I'm talking, of course, about the fabulous Stephen James class that he talked about that. And it's true, because when you think about that and you're getting yourself into predicaments, and you can say writer's block, and of course, there's a lot of people that say it's not true or it's true or whatever. And I think you're kind of right. It's indecisiveness of wondering where to go or what to do, or you're just not maybe in tune with your characters enough, or you're not listening.
I'm so glad you said listening, John.
Yeah.
Because
that's because a lot of men really don't do that well.
I come from a family of very high testosterone women, and we don't listen all that well either. So,
right.
Hey, you know. No, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's the other thing that's the big skill in improv that people are not good at. And it's the one thing, you know, it's the note you'll hear most often in improv class, listen, listen, listen. And I think that once you become a little more used to listening to other people in an improv class, then you become better at it in your writing. And I think that's really key that you brought that up.
Now, the one thing that I always find that I always kind of ask authors, because I find it more and more happening, and I see it, is with social media being so instant, and whenever a book comes out, you know, like with Stephen or you, Carol, whenever you see that instant reaction from fans or from readers, and they're focusing on something that you're kind of like, wow, I can't believe that they picked that up or this and that. I start to see authors use that as maybe into their next book, and I feel that it kind of takes a little bit away from them because they're kind of seeing what people like and what they're interested in maybe, and they're trying to weave something into a story that's not really theirs. It's like they're almost listening too much to social media, and I don't know if you do that or not, like with the reviews, like people are saying certain things, and maybe you're like influencing that into your next story. Like, yeah, but a lot of people really liked this, so maybe I should go this way. And it almost, and I don't know if that's forcing yourself into doing something that you're not comfortable in doing.
Well, that's a really interesting question.
I only bring up interesting ones. That's all I
allow. That's all you allow.
That's all I allow.
I've never done anything I'm not comfortable doing, except once in college at a fraternity. Well, that's, you know, that's a different thing. but I I value feedback, but I maybe I'm arrogant enough to think, well, you know, I can't please everyone all the time, and I can't, you know, if I can use a comment, that's fabulous. But I get most of the feedback I need from, you know, either my agent and her minions, or my editor and her minions. Though I will say, I had my first novel was a Sherlock Holmes novel, The Star of India, and there were you can only imagine what the fan base is like for the Sherlock Holmes empire. I mean, you know, these are people who, you know, they invented the Ur nerd. Or being a German word for origin.
Exactly.
And so, like, I had all these people read, you know, telling me that, you know, crinoline didn't come in until, you know, crinoline wouldn't have been worn then. And so I loved it because when the book was reissued, it was bought by Titan in the UK a couple of years ago. I changed the mistakes, and it was wonderful because all these people had done research for me and, you know, I'm sure really enjoyed telling me how wrong I was, you know, on Amazon or whatever, but then I was able to use, you know, their corrections. So I really valued that. It was, you know, factual stuff, but it was very useful.
You know, when you guys were talking about that, it made me think of, I was at the Nashville Film Festival a couple of weeks ago, and some of these guys from Hollywood were talking about, they were screenwriters, right? And different networks or shows or whatever, like, let's say Warner Brothers or whoever it might be. They'll have, like, a social media department now, a social department. Mm-hmm. And, like, after the show comes out, they'll be analyzing tweets. And, like, there might be someone from Idaho tweets, you know, I didn't like whatever, they should do this or something. And then, literally, like, a producer from the studio will come to the writer and be like, I think we maybe should change this or something. And the writer's like, why, you know? Well, we were hearing from, you know, a listener. And there's, like, this is some guy who knows nothing about story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it ends up getting this weird voice to people that... I mean, I love hearing from writers, you know, readers and fans and stuff, but to think about reshaping, you know, your story just because of someone's tweet is just crazy.
Because I work a lot in theater and because that's so collaborative, you know, and I'm actually having another table read on Tuesday of a play of mine that's going to get produced. I listen really carefully to what people have to say, and my feeling is if three or more people give me the same note about a piece, no matter what it is, then I really need to look at it carefully. And if there are people I trust, and especially if they see it or read it at different times, and then I hear the same thing, I hear it once, I hear it twice, I hear something three times, I think that is something I really need to look at. But I think then you also have to take it and say, well, does this comment resonate with me? Do I really, you know, and then you sleep on it, and if the answer is yes, then you should have the courage to change it. But I also have seen students, and I've had a lot of students, and I've had people who have changed things to please their critics. And that's some of that is just lack of experience and lack of, you know, self-confidence of you know, this is my vision and you write your own story, you know. So I think there's a really fine line between listening to a critic who's really onto something or – you know, just changing it because you want to please them. And it's a fine line, and I can't say where it begins and ends, but I think it's a real issue.
Yeah, after you mentioned Del Close earlier, I was trying to put my finger on this quote that I had read. I'll just read to you because I actually think it's a good kind of segue from, you know, talking about improv and being comedic and also writing sort of the suspenseful novels that both of you and I really kind of delve into. But it says, deliberately trying to be funny or witty is a considerable drawback and often leads to disaster. Honest responses are simpler and more effective. By the same token, making patterns and connections is much more important than making jokes.
Dell say that?
Yeah. And I just love how the emphasis is on honest responses, right? It's like what ends up being funny isn't that I make fun of someone or whatever, but it's like it resonates when the people hear it. They're like, oh, yeah, that's true. I never really thought of that before. Or that honesty is what resonates. It isn't trying to be funny or witty or trying to be literary or trying to be scary or whatever. It's like creating a scene that's honest, that when we read it, we feel an authenticity to it. And I think that's great, yeah.
Well, I agree with you. I think truth is where all really great comedy comes from. Someone once said, that what writers do is they either tell us about things that we've always known but never, quite been able to put in those words before, or they tell us about things that we can't possibly have imagined. I think great stand-ups, I'm a big fan of stand-up, and I think great stand-ups tend to talk about, things that we all know and experience, but they shine a light on it and express it in a way that we've never thought about it before. And I think it's the truth of their remarks that, always makes them great, makes them for a really great stand-up.
Do you think that the golden age of stand-up has passed us by? Because whenever I watch stand-up, funny thing is, whenever I watch stand-up, and I watch a lot of stand-up, it's like all I hear is a lot of relationship and sex jokes, and it seems like there's just no originality anymore, where you used to be able, in the late 80s and the 90s, you had 20 different comedians, and they were all 20 different. Now it's like you put 20 on the stage, and they all blend together, and I forgot who the last one was.
No, I have to disagree with you there.
Wonderful. I like disagreement.
Now
we're getting into it. Disagree with me, I'll tell you. No.
No, let me tell you.
Oh, let's go.
Some of my favorites.
This is Steven's new segment called The Throwdown.
The Throwdown. I think what's happening today that's incredibly exciting is that there are people who of different backgrounds and different ethnic origins that we didn't, and disabled comedians in wheelchairs, people that we would not have heard from 20 years ago, and people like Russell Peters comes to mind. He's Canadian Indian, and he's very, very Canadian, but he uses his background. He has Indian parents. He uses that. Amy Schumer's doing things about sex that are shocking and vulgar and
I gotta say, I'm gonna go on the record right now, I can't stand her.
I understand that, and the first three times I saw her, I went, oh my god, she's so vulgar. But if you see her show, if you see any parts of her show, you'll see that she's saying things about people's attitude towards women that really need to be said. And I have to say, she's not necessarily my cup of tea in her stand-up because it's so vulgar, but I think she's important, and I think she's kind of heroic.
And I don't even care about the vulgar part, because I thought Richard Pryor was hilarious when he did his stuff. And I think what I see a lot of is it leaks into the writings of movies where, they just redid National Lampoon's Vacation, probably the top 10 worst movies ever made on the planet. Because everything just seems to be, a sex joke or a penis joke or this and that.
I agree with you.
And I'm just like, I gotta go, where's the originality anymore?
With Amy Schumer, I think you have to look behind what she's saying and look at the.
Yeah, and I'm just sitting there and I go, and they write a line and it's like, okay, insert penis joke here. And I'm like, come on, can't you think of something else? I mean, even Eddie Murphy was vulgar, but he did it in a funny way. Richard Pryor did it in a funny way. And then you had the exact opposite, where Bill Cosby was vulgar off stage, but on stage he was extremely, never cussed, never did any of that stuff. Then you had George Carlin, then you had Stephen Wright, then you had all these great people, and it just seems like the writing has gotten lazy to me. And I think maybe that's the better term.
Can I insert a little story about Stephen Wright?
He's hilarious. I love him.
I played baseball with him before I knew who he was, and I guess he wasn't like that well known yet. But he was a friend. He was a friend of this other guy who was in my improv group, who was from Boston. Steve was from Boston, and it's just like, we're gonna play baseball, and then this guy Steven's playing third base, and I remember meeting him. And he's like, hey, how you doing? Hi. How are you?
Yep, that's Steven.
And I said, John, who is your depressed friend playing third base? And he was like, oh, he's a stand-up. I said, no, really, seriously, who is he? And he was precisely and exactly like that in real life, like that low affect, And then, later on I saw a stand-up, and I really appreciated it because that's the way he played. He was a very good third baseman, I should say, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, we just went to a taping of The Ellen Show Thursday, And so if you watch the Johnny Depp episode, I am very much on TV. If you know what I look like, you'll see me. And when she did her stand-up I thought was groundbreaking for women, and I thought it was very good. And I think that her show kind of resonates that a little bit more. And so, I don't know. I just feel that there's something missing, and I'm not sure if it's just the originality of, I think because TV and movies have gotten so beyond the risque, where All in the Family, the jokes that they had back then were like taboo, no way. Now it's just like commonplace, and there's no shocking anymore. I mean, do you really get shocked when you watch a comedic show? Because they're pushing the boundary so far that I don't even think there is a boundary anymore. But like I said, you watch All in the Family and you hear those racist jokes, you almost cringe now. You're like, I can't believe we used to laugh at that in the 70s.
I was in school in the 70s, so I actually that whole time period is a complete blank for me. Like, I don't even know.
Yeah, I get
like,
you.
I
from 16 to 20, I'm kind of not around. I forget my 4 years, too.
So this is really interesting because this whole idea of truth and comedy and stories and, you know, the thing is, like, if someone's offended by let's say the comedy or the content that you might put in a book, it immediately becomes a roadblock to them enjoying the show. Like what you were saying, John, you know, it's like just get past it, do something original. And it's like when we write, let's say a novel or let's say we're doing improv, whatever it is, as soon as we throw up those roadblocks, immediately people are going to be like turned off. And our whole goal really is to entertain them. And it's intriguing to me, Carol, because you've done all this stuff with comedy and improv, and yet you write really pretty dark, you know, stories. At least the novels that I've seen.
Yeah. And, I got very interested in criminal psychology some years ago, and around the time I discovered that my brother was a sociopath. And
now that's a line you don't hear every day.
I was just going to say that.
But I had several years of therapy before I realized the truth of this. And I think that's kind of what catapulted me into that, you know, into my I almost want to say obsession with pathological behavior. And then, you know, I studied at I went to John Jay and I took a graduate course in criminal psychology. I'm actually meeting with my professor next week because he said there's some new research in it. And he's been on some of those, true crime shows on TV. He's a really cool guy. And I really just became fascinated with that. And I don't think that it's necessarily true that just because you love comedy, you know, the people in comedy are some of the darkest people I've ever known. So, you know, I don't think there's a contradiction there particularly.
Yeah, no, I don't either. I just think it's fascinating. You know, it's like, I like to do, I mean, when I speak, I often do some comedy. I don't know, I'm not a comedian so, per se, but I like to do comedy bits and humorous stories, and then people are like, wait a minute, you just wrote that book. Are you saying that? I'm like, I mean, it's just about entertaining people and telling great stories, you know. And
I think there is that, absolutely. And for me doing improv, you know, when I was doing improv, I was really attracted to story structure. Like, I know, of course, you have to have a basic level of funny, otherwise, you know, people won't pay you to improvise. But I think for me, I was just like, how can we make that story that we just did, you know, what went wrong with it? How can we make it better? You know, what were the structural flaws? So, you know, I've always been just very deeply attracted to structure. Like, it just really interests me. And I think that's, you know, I think if you're a writer and you're not interested in structure, you're going to have to, you know, you better create damn good characters and setting or you might be in some trouble.
Yeah, actually, that's really good. When you think about structure relating to story, like, how does that inform the stories that you either write for plays that you might write or novels that you might write? In other words, what are you thinking of when you say structure? Is it the movement of the story or through certain number of acts?
And, you know, I'm not embarrassed to say I've read Robert McKee's book 5 times, the book called Story. I feel like I should get royalties from that guy. I've recommended his book so many times. I should really get it paid out. Because he's one of the people who talks, you know, most intelligently about structure. Yeah, and each discipline has a different has a different, type of structure you can get away with. I like playwriting because it's so free. And I think in a play you can get away with certain things as long as you can, keep all the balls in the air. You can get away possibly with a looser structure or a more experimental structure than you can in a novel, where I think you especially in an action genre, you really have to keep it pushing along. But I think all of the stuff, a lot of the things that we learned in seventh grade are still true. You have to have a protagonist face with a problem, and you have to have rising action that leads to a climax. All of the things that I've taught my students over and over again. But then the beauty of it is that there are endless variations and endless, ways of twisting that and surprising yourself as you go. And my favorite things is when I surprise myself.
I love that too. Yeah, when I'm writing.
I don't know. Is that specific enough to what you're talking about? Or
sure.
Want more?
Some people do. They look at specific act and inciting incident. I know McKee is really kind of into certain language like that. But I think that a lot of stories actually, break a lot of those rules.
I am a big fan of stories that can break rules, and I think if you have other things really in place, like. I was talking with my students about Alexander McCall Smith, who I love, and his African novels, the Ladies Detective Agency. And I was saying, I don't even care how much of a story there is. I just want to be with those people. I just want to hang out with them. I just really like them. I love the characters. I love the setting. It's so charming. And I just want to have tea with them and hang out. And of course, that's not really true, but it kind of feels that way. These people are just really fun to be around. And if you can create a place and a cast that people really love, you can get away with a lot more in terms of whether or not you tell a great story. But I also feel like if you churn, there's a time where if you make your whole job about just churning out a plot that's like a machine that kind of grinds into the next gear and then the plot grinds there, and that's all that you focus on, you're in big trouble. So this word organic, kind of surfaces and I almost hate to use it because, having spent so much time in Woodstock, I have almost a thing against organic. But
gotcha.
but I think that there's an organic quality, and it's that balance that John was talking earlier about listening. And I think it's this balance between knowing what the so-called rules are, knowing what the conventions are, and then being able to listen to the internal logic for your own story. And there comes a time where you go, the traditional thing would be, it's the same thing in writing music when you write music. It's the traditional thing would be to go to the subdominant here, but you know what? I'm going to use a substitution chord, and I'm not going to go to the subdominant, and then, I'm going to go somewhere else. I'm going to be more adventuresome. So it's that balance between predictability and surprise, and I think the greatest storytellers just walk that tightrope all the time. They're like, predict, I'm going to surprise you. And they twist the story in a way that seems surprising, and yet in hindsight it seems entirely logical.
Yeah, I love it. I teach organic writing. I unashamedly. That's really no. I'm not
I
saying
you,
you,
I
you
hope
have
you bring
to do
kale.
It. Yeah, kale. Exactly.
I hope you have your kale.
And so as long as I have both you guys on the show today, this is really kind of very important, and we should probably cue the music or something. But
uh-oh.
I'm
I ain't got no music, man. I'm going to have to insert some music.
But I'm interested in the difference between suspense, mystery, and what? And,
here we
and
go,
horror.
Thriller,
no,
horror.
See, okay, so, Carol, you've got to listen to John's distinction between
I want John to do the heavy lifting here. John,
listen to John's distinction, then you can agree, disagree, or anything like that. So, John, go ahead and tell us the difference between the genres.
So I spent a lot of time, and I decided, because a lot of people don't know what they write, and I always used to say, how can you not understand what you write? And I said, well, maybe you don't understand what the genres mean. So I said, well, let's put some definitions to them. So I sat down, I thought, and I said, okay, let's start talking about mystery. And so when you're writing a mystery is you're walking up a hill or a mountain, and you see a clue, maybe a bloody glove, and then you walk up and you see a knife, or, you find a clue, you get to the end, and everything gets revealed. it's all right there. Boom. Now you know you have a mystery. When you have suspense, you're walking up the same mountain. You're kind of going at a slower pace. You kind of hear a door creaking, or you hear some noise in the background, and you start to get the hair, you know, the hairs on your neck start to stand up a little bit. You're starting to get a little, you know, nervous. You get to the end, and bam, the climax just hits you all in the face. I mean, you're just getting yourself up there, and there you go. When you talk thriller, you're going the same mountain, except you're running as fast as you can. You got bombs blowing up all across. You got shit flying over your head, everything else. You get to the top, and you just jump off the edge because you're just done. When you go to horror, horror really has no rules because you can incorporate all that stuff in there. You know, that's where you have the ghosts and the goblins and the ghost stories and everything else, and you're just freaked out and you're scared to death. You get to the end, and you can finally breathe because either the bad guy died or something happened, but at least you know that the story's either ending or a new one's beginning, and that, and you're just scared to death. And then if you want to write science fiction, you just take any of those elements and just throw them on Mars, and then there you go. Done. So that's kind of how I defined the genres, because, again, I would interview so many people, and they wouldn't understand what they wrote. And I said, well, do you even know what genre you write? And they said, oh, well, you know, I write suspense. And then they start talking to me, and I go, well, that's a thriller. That's not a suspense book. And then I also started figuring out, I said, you know, I said, there's maybe only two styles of not really stuff, paces of writing. Either you're writing a suspense pace, which is a slow build climaxing to the very, very end, or you're writing a thriller pace. You're racing through as fast as you can. Because mystery and horror aren't really a pace. They're a style within the pace you're writing. So that's just kind of how I defined it, to just try to make it maybe a little easier. So that's what
Isn't that great, Carol?
Wow. What he said.
Oh, that's not fair. That's cheating.
I love John. You're like, if you want to make science fiction, just stick it on Mars.
Stick it on Mars. There you go.
That's so funny. I'm going to revise my business card. My business card is actually going to say stick it on Mars.
Stick it on Mars.
Because I just think, you know, it's a one-way trip, but, you know, it's worth it.
But when you look, all those books that we love and we get, they all fit into one of those categories, one of those five categories.
Well, a lot
of the fiction does.
Well, let's go back to Shakespeare. So with your definition, I made a little note here. With your definition, Hamlet is mystery, Macbeth is horror, Othello is suspense, and The Tempest is science fiction.
There you go.
There you go.
Bam. We took 300 years of writing and just combined it here in 30 seconds.
There you go. That's what we would say here in New York. I missed the fifth category. What was the fifth category?
Well, you had mystery, suspense, thriller, horror, and then science fiction.
Thriller.
So thriller, and then that's, you know, and they always talk about the pace of a thriller. And it's like you guys were talking about rules. And the one thing that I love, well, like when I sit and I write and I think, I don't think one iota about a rule. I just want to say, I just throw the words out, I get the story out, I get what it is, and I don't care about rules more than anything else. There's a great book that I read once, it was called Story Trump Structure, and so I always wanted to make sure that the story was the most important thing, and I didn't care about rules. Who is the author of that book? Oh, it's our host, Stephen James. And,
And
I've read David Morrell's, and I've read Stephen King's, and I've read these books on writing, but I think if you start putting rules on things, you start killing creativity, and you should never kill creativity.
Well, allowed
to flourish.
Can I just use the word that I prefer to rules, which is conventions? I think there's something organic about storytelling evolved, and since it evolved, I think what we have are a series of conventions rather than quote rules unquote, and I think they evolved because they work. And you know, cliches are the same thing. I mean, they became cliches because they had something true about them in the beginning. That's why they became cliches. So I think that that I too, like you, I'm uncomfortable with the notion of rules.
Yeah.
But I think that to know what the conventions of your genre are and to know what the things that people have done that have worked, I think that that's a very good idea. And then if you want to go in the other direction, you're doing that with knowledge. You're not just doing it because you don't know what the hell you're doing, if you know what I mean. It's like,
that's good. Yeah. No, I
it's
know.
Like studying,
advice,
you know, if you study counterpoint, you know, and then when you go, and then when you do something adventuresome, you know that you're doing something adventuresome, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, respecting the genres, understanding them, and even extending them, and you know, building new, you know, genres from.
Right. Or as I tell my students, Picasso really was a hell of a draftsman. He could really draw. Like, that dude could really draw. And then he became, like, you know, a cubist. But he could, you know, he could draw a damn nude, man. He could really, you know, before he went in other directions. And I guess not every great artist has to, you know, learn how to draw a great still life or a nude or whatever it is, you know, you do in art school. But I think it really helps if you can write a really sort of traditional, well-made story. And then when you experiment, you know, you're doing it with knowledge, and you're doing it not from a place of ignorance, but from a place of knowledge.
Yeah, that's I like that. And Carol, I had the honor a few years ago of endorsing one of your books, and I'm trying to remember the name. It was the one about the steampunk.
Oh, the steampunk.
The MERS. What was it? The silent.
Yeah, steampunk was Silent Kills.
Silent Kills.
Silent Kills. Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
And it was. It had this real dark vibe to it, and but I really liked the atmosphere of it. And
oh,
I don't remember anything about plot. I mean, like,
I don't,
plot
I don't either.
Or,
I don't remember my own plot, so I don't feel too
No. But it, I left it. It was like a resonant atmosphere. And, you know,
cool.
In this whole discussion about rules, like, I don't remember what was Act 1 or Act 2. You know,
yeah.
I mean, kind of remember, like, the broad scope of the sweep of the story, but just this dark atmospheric mood that you were able to capture, which.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, which that's fantastic. As far as a writer, can we capture it through the voice or the mood, or what is it that resonates with people?
Yeah, yeah, and that's what. And ultimately, I tend not to remember. It's funny because I love structure so much. I love story structure, and yet I tend not to remember them. You know, maybe I'll remember an amazing twist that somebody did, but yeah, I'd have to go through. You know, and I think I come away with the same thing you come away with, which is like, what's the over? Did I enjoy being in that world, and do I want to go back to that world? But it's funny, I did kind of break a rule in that book at the end. It's funny that you mention it, because I have this advice I always give my students, which is, you know, one point of view character per scene. You know, if you're gonna break that, you know, break it carefully and with. And I did that in that book. I have a big party scene at the end. I have a steampunk concert, actually in the Melville House, which is upstate New York, and I actually have this big concert in this, and I have three or four point of view characters, because the detective, the criminal profiler, the killer, and the intended victim are all in that room, and I kind of switch around from one point of view to another. But I remember being really worried about doing it. And really trying to do it carefully so that it was clear and not confusing. And, you know, I thought my editor was going to, like, you know, come back and say, you can't do that. Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
You know. But I remember,
does your editor,
like,
talk like that? Because that'd be cool.
Who do you think? Yeah, my editor actually has a...
Can we get them on the show with you one time?
She actually comes in with a megaphone. She's like
oh,
behind a curtain. And she's like, pay no attention to that little man. Yeah.
So what do you have on the horizon? Do you have a book coming out, or do you have any latest projects we want to let our listeners you know, look into here? We have just a few more minutes left, and
I want
to make sure that we direct
people
to wherever they might what's going on?
Well, I have this, as I mentioned before, I actually this play of mine about string theory, about quantum physics, as it were, is going to be done in New York and also in Washington, D.C. They did it at the Kennedy Center last fall, and then it's going to be done again as a regular production in Washington. And then I have several producers in New York that are working on it. It's called Strings. It was done originally with Keir DeLay and Maya Dillon. in New York, and then they're looking at this second production now. So that's like a thing. That's a thing. That's a thing.
So how do we get tickets, or when is that?
Well, it's going to be at the Pulse Theater. It's going to be produced by the Pulse Theater Company, and we have another table read actually this Tuesday. So we don't have a production date yet because they're really looking for some. Hey, listen, if you know any actors who are sort of well known that you know would be interested in playing physicists, let us know. And my next, when I was in Edinburgh, I wrote my next series is historical fiction. It's a historical thriller called Edinburgh Twilight, and it takes place in 1880, and it's about a detective in the Edinburgh police force who is stalking a serial killer who's operating in 19th century Edinburgh. And he actually crosses paths with Conan Doyle, who happened to be at the Edinburgh, medical school at the time. So he doesn't in the first book. He doesn't cross paths with Conan Doyle, but he does in the second book. So,
man, I don't know how you guys do the historical books. I mean, that's just crazy amount of research for me.
I
don't know how you pull that off, man.
But I love it when you bring in those people into your story. I've always wondered, like, and I've even asked Stephen one time, like, what if Patrick Bowers went up against, like, Ted Bundy, you know, like real-life Ted Bundy or something like that? I go, wouldn't that be kind of cool, you know, to kind of have that kind of thing? And, I don't think so. But I do find it interesting, and I love when you find those historical people that kind of come into those stories, because it's just like, wow, this kind of, it's meshing, it's like real world with, you know, with the fiction world. And I just think that that's just very cool.
Yeah. Well, you're right about the research. It was tons of research, but it's also an excuse to go back and hang out in Edinburgh. So, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's just the sense of history. It just kind of seeps from the cobblestones. I mean, it's just the most amazing place. And so when you're in Edinburgh, you just feel like you're in another century. You're not really in the 20th, the 21st. You kind of 19th or earlier. And so I'm very interested in that era. So, you know, I did choose 1880 so that he could interact with Conan Doyle and Joseph Bell, who, you know, as everyone probably knows by now, was one of the models for Sherlock Holmes, who was Conan Doyle's professor at medical school, who is famous for making these diagnoses based on just observing people. So he's going to cross paths with these people, and it's going to influence him as a, you know, as a policeman, as a detective.
That sounds great. Hey, so where online can readers find you, maybe your schedule or when your show might be produced?
Oh, okay.
So
it's celawrence.com.
And that's Lawrence, L-A-W, right?
L-A-W, right, celawrence.com. And there are links on that website. There's a theater link that, you know, links you to the plays and stuff. And then when the books come out, I'm sure we'll be announcing it. So Edinburgh Twilight is the first one, and the second one is Edinburgh Dusk, and we don't have a pub date yet, but hopefully it won't be too long.
Sounds good. Yeah. This has been a great – and then time has
flown by.
Me. Like, yeah, it flew by. But I love the insights, you know, about improv, just the ideas about respecting structure but being willing to break it in the service of story. That's excellent.
Yeah,
and
I think, you know, we have to remember that, I mean, what I keep telling, you know, having to remind myself is that these terms that we've come up with for these things, stories existed before people found a way to talk about the stories, you know? So, like, talking about, you know, these stories existed in campfire, you know, in front of, our ancestors were telling the story about being chased by the saber-toothed tiger in front of fires and caves. And I think that probably, you know, people didn't have time to sit around and say, you know, I really thought that was your climax was a little weak. You should have described the saber-toothed tiger coming at you from a distance. You know, I doubt they had time to talk about those kinds of things because they were too busy finding the next meal. So we kind of have the luxury now of analyzing things that have existed since the beginning of spoken language.
Yeah, it's cool. Very profound place to end. So
there you go.
Yeah, Carol, no, that was good. We got lots of bumper stickers that we can create now, and business cards.
There you go.
Well, thanks everybody for listening. For information about my novel writing intensive retreats, which we are now taking registrations for in October, it'll be in Dallas, novelwritingintensive.com. And John, tell us a little quick about Suspense Radio and publishing. And
yeah, you can go to suspensemagazine.com, of course. You can also subscribe to Suspense Radio by going to iTunes, and this show and all the other shows that are produced on there will go right into your listening device. You can listen to them whenever you want to. You know, of course, we have the magazine publishing company, Radio, and coming, and I will say this for the first time on radio, coming January 1st, 2017, Suspense Magazine changes how the genre will now be covered. So that's going to be something exciting because I think that it's stale. I think that it's getting mundane and it's boring. So I'm changing how this stuff is going to be done. A lot of free stuff coming out. I'll just say that.
That's excellent. And so for more info about our guests and to check out other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you.